The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
And good day, ladies and gentlemen. It is February 1st, 2014. Thanks for joining me on this beautiful, warm Saturday here where I am. It seems like it's always a beautiful Saturday when I'm staying inside to do this program. But I did get some laundry out on the line in the sun and light breeze. So I'm happy that I got that done, and I can even see it from where I'm sitting. So I like to see things out on the line, you know, on the clothesline. I always use the clothesline. That's one thing I like about living in the South, is that I can hang the laundry out all year round, and I do. I find the warmer days, and I do it then. I never use my clothes dryer. All right, to get on with things, I have a lot of material today. I feel like I have a ton of stuff. So we'll see how it goes. I want to know if my sound seems to be okay now. All right, I was going to turn it down at this point, but I better not. I better leave it where it is. All right, contributors. There is another contributor I want to mention, just came through today. Todd from Columbia, South Carolina. He's also somebody, a new, and he wrote a nice little message, and he said he was blown away by my brilliant website. Boy, don't I like to hear things like that. So thank you, Todd, and welcome, and stick around. Now, there's always new people finding my site and finding things. It's just, that's what's so great to realize that there's people who you'd think would know about it if they like it so much, but they don't know about it yet. They haven't known about it, but they find it. So that's great. We need to keep people finding this material. There's probably a lot more people who would like it than we realize. an anniversary came up, which I missed, and I didn't plan to mention this today, but I'm going to. It was January 30th, and it was the anniversary of the sinking of the Wilhelm Gustloff, that ship that was carrying all those refugees, when it was sunk by a Soviet submarine. Now, I just find it amazing, and there was three of them. Another one was sunk on February 10th. That was I might forget to mention that, but I mention that now. It was just, 11 or 12 days later, the General Steuben was also loaded up with refugees and wounded soldiers, and they sunk that too. And then there was a third one in April. I'll mention that, but I might do something on that when April rolls around, if I can remember to do that, because it was the worst of all. I find it astounding that at this late point in the war, in 1945, when these refugees were trying to escape to Germany proper, these Soviets were sinking these ships that they were on. They knew what they were. They knew what they were. I don't know. They had so many people on these ships that I don't see how they could have figured that they had anything else. And what would they, since Germany was simply trying to now salvage Berlin, so to speak, I don't see what they thought they were, the ships could be carrying that would be dangerous or damaging to them. They didn't. It's horrible. So let me just cover this. That on this one page I was looking at, actually it's at the IHR website, It says many people continue to think the sinking of the Titanic, which took place in 1912, with the loss of 1,523 men, women, and children, was history's greatest maritime disaster. Others may perhaps think of the British passenger liner Lusitania, which sank on May 7, 1915, 3 years later, after being hit by a German submarine torpedo, taking 1,198 lives. Well, in this case, the war was ongoing. Germany had warned about ships carrying contraband from the United States to Britain, and that they were going to be shooting these things. And they tried to pan that off as the Germans had information that this ship was carrying a bunch of stuff. And it was. it was found out later through, I think, discovering the ship down at the bottom of the ocean, and what was there. And the British tried, and Americans tried to say that there wasn't any contraband and make that a big crime against the Germans. But in this case, they were justified in doing so because it was against, I don't know if you call it against the laws, but it was against the war protocols, you know, all the conventions and so on, for the United States to be supplying material. The United States was a neutral country, was not allowed to be supplying material to Britain, which was a belligerent country, but it was doing so. So they were breaking the laws. They were doing wrong in this case. But in the case of these three ships, everybody knew what was going on with these ships. So the Wilhelm Gustloff, let's see, let me get to just to that, was the first one. It was a 25,000-ton converted luxury liner that had been serving as a hospital ship. And it had been a hospital ship for a long time, for some time, probably a couple years or so, at least. When it left the Baltic harbor of Gdynia, which in German is Gotenhafen, on January 30th, 1945, so you all should know where that is. That's up there, you know, in the around the you know, in that that area that was so contested. I can't. It's probably down here a little further. I can't come up with the name of it now. It's terrible. Anyway, I'll just go on. When it left from there, from that harbor, it was January 30th, 1945, cold, 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 sent in the middle of winter, and they take off at night because they think that they'll be safer at night than in the daytime. From planes and so on. And it was carrying 5,000 refugees, mostly women and children, and 1,600 military servicemen. That is, you know, basically wounded or who weren't the ones who could still be marching and so on. They were the hospital patients. And they took off at shortly after 9 o'clock in the evening. And they were struck by three torpedoes from Soviet submarine S-13. Convoy vessels were able to rescue only about 900 of these 6,600 people from the sub-freezing Baltic waters. At least 5,400 perished, at least. Sometimes there were more people on those ships than they even said. You know, these people were trying so hard to cram themselves on there to get away. So that's a war crime. It should have been considered a war crime, even at the time. Why wasn't it? And in fact, it happened twice more. Why shouldn't refugees are supposed to be allowed to flee? But no, they didn't. They wanted to kill all these people, all these Germans, because the idea was to kill every German they could. They didn't care who they were. Now, when on February 10th, when the General Steuben loaded up, and it was overloaded, it was it left shortly after midnight, and it sank with the loss of 3,500 lives, making it the third worst maritime disaster in history, and the same Soviet submarine that had attacked the Guslav in almost the same location sank the Steuben with two torpedoes. So after they killed all those people in the first one in such a horrible way, you know, drowning in this freezing water with children and so on, they did it again. They had no, they intended to do all that. They didn't feel bad about it. And this ship was crammed with as many as 5,000, when you include the wounded soldiers that were there and refugees. And it sank in just 7 minutes. So if this is the third worst maritime disaster, and the next one on April 16th of the Goya, another German ship, was the worst one of all, the Guslav must be the second worst. That means these three ships are the three worst maritime disasters in history. But do we hear about that? No, they talk all the time about the Titanic. And if you're talking about wartime, they talk all the time about the Lusitania. Oh, what a crime. Which was not the kind of crime that these were at all, but they don't talk about these unless, you know, you're on a pro-German, pro, you know, revisionist kind of, where you're, you know, trying to get honesty in history. Otherwise, children don't learn about it in school. They learn about these others, I'm quite sure. They never hear about these. Now, what kind of a world, what kind of a system do we have when there's that much anti-Germanism going on still? And that's kind of an undercurrent theme of today's program. So you'll hear a little bit more about that. Now I'm not going to describe all of this third one, but it was the Goya. It had a cargo of 7,000 refugees and wounded soldiers. And on this one, there were only 183 survivors out of that 7,000. And again, it was a Soviet submarine that fired two torpedoes at it, and they found their marks amidship and stern. Well, I might as well talk about it. Almost immediately, the ship broke in half, her mast crashing down, the passengers crowding the decks. But before anyone could escape from the holes, the onrushing sea quickly drowned out the angry screams of the refugees below. The vessel sank in just 4 minutes. That's why so many died, and they weren't able to rescue hardly any. So, you know, these are outstanding crimes, and they would be, in my mind, no matter who they happen to or how, and I just cannot understand how they can continue to promote the Soviet Union. Both it promotes itself and others promote it as being the hero of World War II and so on, after doing things like this. This just shows what their attitude was and their methods. And it was that same, it was the same everywhere. Not just in the naval area, but on the ground troops and Air Force and so on. It's all the same. All right, I'm going to take a little bit of time out. I was very much debating whether to do this or not, and I kept saying, oh, I'll just forget about it. But I don't want to bring attention to it that much. But at the same time, you know, I just can't allow things to be said about my person, myself, that I know are lies. And I believe that the person saying them also knows their lies. And I think, gosh, you know, so I'm going to take just a real short time here to answer some things, once again, by Veronica Clark. You know, she's come out with some stuff. I'm not even going to say where it is or what it is, but some of the things she said in a particular recording, she said that Carolyn said, "I hate Veronica Clark." That's what Miss Yeager said to someone in an email. "I hate Veronica Clark." Now, why would she say that? Why would she hate me? Well, I thought the only time I might have said that would have been in this email to Hoaxbuster, if you know who Hoaxbuster is. I know I wouldn't have said that anywhere else, but I was writing kind of a long thing to him, trying to make him see things that he doesn't see. And, I didn't succeed, but I look back at that, you see, because it's my email. And I did, and I said this. I didn't say what she says I said. And this is how she changes things, you know, from what I actually say to making it different and acting like she's quoting me. I wrote to this person, "I know this." I was talking about Clark. I said, "I know this. She wants special treatment wherever she goes. I actually have come to hate this person, and you tell me to show some respect for her shortcomings. God Almighty." Well, that was just a little part in there that I wrote, and that's the only thing I ever said. So she must have heard from him or something that I said I hated her. And so she puts it in her own language. More she goes on like this, the more I do hate her. which is another likeness to Jews, because, you know, I think she has always expected special treatment, and special treatment is something that Jews expect to get. She also said, "Carolyn Yeager said she wanted to debate me. She's been after me to debate her." Then she said on another time, "I won't debate her because she's insane." Well, that's a lie, because I thought, I can't believe she's saying that. When did I never wanted to debate her? I never said I wanted to debate her. You know, she needs to come up with some proof of these things that she's saying. And then she contradicted herself. She claimed after that that she wanted to debate me, and I run from debate. So she's saying it both ways. None of it is true. She said, Carolyn, I don't know how she said that, asked me to come on her program. Oh, that was 4 or 5 years ago. And I said no. Now, and then she goes on, I declined because she's a racist. And then she went on to say, I think she's jealous because I went on Deanna Spingola's program. Well, you know, she complains that I've heard her say that I'm putting words in her mouth, which I've never done. And yet she's putting words in my mouth and saying things that I never said. I call this a lie. Now, it's possible I have totally forgotten that I once said, well, you know, you want to come on my program. Maybe I was encouraged by Hoaxbuster or something. But I have forgotten it, and I really don't think so. I really don't. And, you know, if she is saying such a thing, she should prove it with an email from me. She should, if she can't prove what she says that happened 4 or 5 years ago that I dispute, she should shut up about it. Why, you know, but that's just part of her running off at the mouth. So, there's more I could say about all that, but I'm not going to. Now, then she said, Carolyn betrayed Rodney Martin when she posted an entire Skype exchange between them. Something like that. Betrayed. She said, oh, it's so terrible. No one will ever send her a Skype message again. That's so awful to post somebody's Skype, messages. And then she said, Rodney said he told her all about his prior work. Before all this, when he was being on her program. And I believe him. Well, nothing was betrayed in those Skype messages, really, except some truth that needed to be exposed. And it was in response to things that Rodney was saying about me, which weren't true. So, or about between he and I. So I thought I needed to show the proof. And now the odd thing is that goes along again with Veronica doing what she accuses other people of doing is that she sent around, emails. She sent around in emails numerous times to all kinds of people and posted on this internet blog she started, the Skype conversation between this person named Iconoclast, or that's his program or something, and Andrew Anglin. So how hypocritical can you be to be saying that about posting people's Skype messages when she posted that, and tried to get as many people as possible to read it? Now, she said, Carolyn asked me on her blog, which she means on the comments to my programs, if I could prove I was 100% white. And then she goes on and on about whether who's 100% white and so on. But you see, I didn't say that. I thought she had posted enough at the White Network and she was posting in the wrong place. And I told her that you know, this was a pro-white network and we weren't going to change. So she wasn't pro-white. So why was she, you know, why did she keep posting here? And, I said that, and in that I said, the only requirement we have here is that commenters are white. So I asked her if she could assure me that she was white, but I never said 100%. Now that's another thing that she has always added that 100% herself. And then implied that, not only implied, but imputed that to me, that I'm going around using the term, are you 100% white? I never use that. I never say that. You know, white is white, and I don't get carried away about 100%. Now, something about, she said something, the last one here, folks. She said something about Hitler from 1944 on would promote the best candidate regardless of race. I'm putting that in my own words. She was saying that Hitler made this big change about his racial views, and from a certain point on, he would promote the best candidate or the most meritorious person regardless of race. And, you know, that's just not true either. I just want to, my objections, and that's from the very beginning with Veronica Clark, were not personal. She tries to make out like I've got this personal thing now, and everything is personal, but it's all based on her presentation of the Third Reich, and in particular Adolf Hitler, which is so far wrong. And I, since I have a special interest in that, you know, I am objecting to that. But she thinks that she has researched everything so well, but she's not really the scholar that she pretends to be. She doesn't have good research, and she doesn't have proof of hardly anything she says. So, you know, one example is when Hitler was seriously searching for a replacement for himself as Führer, it was in 1944, but he had been for some time, even in 43. He finally came up with a choice. It was, and he chose Hans Ulrich Rudel, the German pilot ace, the Stuka pilot, who is the greatest, one of the, probably the biggest ace Germany has ever had in his, you know, all that he accomplished against the enemy. And Hans Ulrich Rudel was 100% German, and that's why he would never have. Hitler would never have chosen anyone who was not German to lead Germany, or even to hold a high office, let alone Führer, but any other really high office. So she's totally wrong about this, and never shows any evidence. And I have to just say that, you know, she says by doing something like this that I'm trying to involve her. No, I'm not trying to involve her. I'm only answering her trying to involve me. You know, she's into stalking now, and she keeps sending comments to the White Network, which I don't post. If she's not, you know, who's trying to involve who? I'm not trying to involve her, but she's trying to involve me. Because she needs the attention from somewhere. She says she doesn't want it, but she actually does. Okay. I probably said a lot more than I intended. I was just going to answer those comments that she made, those statements, but, it takes a little bit more to really explain. So, all right. Last Monday, I reported on a gravestone in a Catholic cemetery in Vienna that had a small swastika on it, and it was confirmed by a listener that it had been defaced by numerous scratches. He sent in the comments to that program a very good enlargement of that gravestone, which you could tell it was kind of fuzzy, but then it showed clearly that somebody had just been scratching away at that little swastika, trying to, make it, I don't know, get rid of it or make at least show that they didn't like it. And so this made me pay attention to this article that is not new. It was from October last year, a few months ago, where about Christian gravestones being vandalized. You know, this just reveals so much about Israel. And, you know, today's program is basically about anti-Semitism. It's anti-Semitic now, not only to speak badly against Jews, but to speak negatively against Israel. So, but Israel, there's so many reasons to speak negatively about Israel, but the Jewish way is that no matter how they behave, they want to have the power to stop people from talking about it. They don't care if you notice it, if you don't say anything. They want to stop any commenting on it. They want to stop any expression of it. But they're busy behaving in ways that, that would cause people to dislike them. And in this, there was an attack on a Protestant cemetery called Mount Zion, one of Jerusalem's most important historic graveyards, and repeated attacks by these youths who come from the Israeli settlements there on the West Bank. You know, they're the extremists. And they're the ultra-nationalists there, you know, who follow all the, you know, the fine points of Judaism. And they're like all non-Jews out of our land. I wouldn't care if all non-Jews left that land. I wouldn't care one bit. I think it'd be better if they did, and then we could just look and show what kind of a, you know, criticize the people of Israel all we want. Because these people are trying so hard to get along there. I don't really know why, but a lot of the Christians there are actually Arabs. In fact, 3/4 of the Christians are Arabs. Only 1/4 of the Christians are, I guess, European or else non-Arab, in Israel. And you know, they call it the Holy Land. The media will alternate that term, Israel and Holy Land. And can you believe to call that place now, with the people that are there in the government and everything, the Holy Land? There's nothing holy about it. You should call it the Holy Land or something. Anyway, it's just a mess. It's just a mess by allowing those Jews to go there. Once you make a mistake like that, it just builds and gets worse and worse and worse. You can't undo it. You know, you have to undo it from the beginning. You can't fix it. I mean, you can't make things better. You have to go back to the beginning and undo what you did. Nobody even contemplates that. So, but see, the police there, they arrested 4 young Israeli settlers, at that time. 2 of them were minors, and they were subsequently released without charge until further questioning. And I don't think anything's ever been done in these months against those youths. 2 of them had already been banned from entering the the West Bank itself because of their connection to some hilltop youth movement of young Jewish extremists that had been blamed for a spate of attacks in recent years on mosques, Christian sites, and Israeli army property to protest government policy. They claimed when they were, you know, brought into custody, they claimed that they had entered the cemetery to immerse themselves in a ritual bath. But the person who takes care of the cemetery, he's a Christian, but Arab Christian. His name is Naum, one of his names. He said that the alibi was suspect because that ritual bath contains no water, and there's an old well nearby, but it's too dangerous to enter it because it's a very narrow opening. You know, you could drown in there and so on. So he doesn't believe them. They come there. They come break into the cemetery to do damage. And they have done all kinds of damage to these graves. And I have, there's a picture of one that I'm looking at that is, you know, it's a flat covering. You know how a grave is a certain, you know, rectangular size. And then what they do there, they cover the whole thing with the concrete and put some decoration on it and say who it is, and has some, looks like Arabic, but could be, looks like Arabic writing on it. But it was, they smash it up with a sledgehammer and it's all broken up, you know, that covering thing. It's all broken up. You couldn't really repair it. And then they go to the Christian crosses that are on top of a grave marker, and they knock those off, and then they break them up with a sledgehammer. That's how, you know, I mean, that's how they hate Christianity. And that's another underlying theme of this program today, is that it's always, well, I'll try to bring that out later. Anyway, let me think, I've said enough about this. They don't do anything about these youths. That's the main point. They know who they are. They call them in. They question them. These youths give their weak excuses, their alibis, and so on. And then the police let them go and say, well, we're looking into this or whatever. They will not punish their fellow Jews, these Jewish youths. They won't do it. And the Christians are afraid to complain too much to the police because some of them are on special visas and they don't think that the police are going to, you know, they're going to get in trouble for themselves. They're afraid. So people there, Christians say there's very strong feeling that the police are not doing enough. They're not doing work to prevent the phenomenon. Well, that's what she said. Yeah, that's what this woman said, who's at the Jerusalem Center for Jewish Christian Relations. And then he said that last week, they arrested 14 youths in connection with attacks on Arabs, but they're never charged. I think we know that. They never say that they're, you know, what happens to these youths or that they're put in prison or something. They never are because of the whole thing is that Jews will not punish their own people particularly for doing things against Gentiles. Now, if you kill a Jew, you'll be punished. But if you harm a Gentile, they'll go through they'll pretend like they'll say, oh, we're so against that. And, oh, they'll bring him in for questioning and they'll maybe detain him for a while, whatever. Maybe they'll have their family, you know, watch over him better or something. But they'll never really punish him because a Jew can't punish a Jew for harming a Gentile. That's the way I see it. And it seems to pan out that way. Now compare that to how the Jews handle, you know, you might say anti-Gentilism, how they handle that with their demands for doing something about anti-Semitism. And a new story from yesterday, 24, and this is the same old stuff. And it's just Jews doing this. I mean, I don't put too much into it, except that they eventually, if they keep going, they eventually get people, you know, get these things accomplished. And there's 24 European parliamentarians who called on the European Union to reinstate its working definition of anti-Semitism. As some of you may know, or if not, I'll remind you that the the EU Fundamental Rights Agency had a what it called a working definition of anti-Semitism, and then they got rid of it, and they said that it didn't they didn't think that was really very good, and they didn't know how to define anti-Semitism. And so now this is, you know, the European Union. And so they didn't, they've been without a definition. I don't think they want to have a definition of it. But now the Jews don't like that. So, you know, if that happened a few months ago, and you may have read about it. But these lawmakers, they've got to be all Jews, every one of them. And they are the ones who went to traveled to Poland last week to attend the International Holocaust Remembrance Day at Auschwitz. And either while there or since then, they have gotten together and they are calling on the European Monitoring Center on Racism and Xenophobia. No, that was in 2005. They're calling on this this agency to reinstate a definition of anti-Semitism, and also to work very hard to abolish anti-Semitism. And let me, there has never been a more pressing time for European parliamentarians and elected officials to show a clear sign of their determination and willingness to fight anti-Semitism, said Vladimir Slutsker, chair of the Brussels-based European Friends of Israel organization, which sponsored the parliamentarians to go to Poland to meet with the Israeli along with the Israeli Jewish Congress. Well, these people, you know, they're Jews. They're ceaselessly working to get these laws on the books, and they're unhappy that this definition was removed, and they want the definition. Where is that? To be to say, oh yeah, they want it to include demonization of the state of Israel and comparing it to Nazi Germany. That's got to be in the definition of anti-Semitism. Now, the thing about anti-Semitism that is we need to be so alert to it, because as you know, I can't think of how to begin this. In Bolshevik Russia, under Lenin and Trotsky and under Stalin, you know, they had a law once they took power, got rid of the Tsar. They had a law that you got the death penalty for expressing anti-Semitism. You know, they took that so seriously that anti-Semitism was not only just against the law and criminal. I mean, you could even get the death penalty, a death sentence for it. So that is what they want. When they have their way, that is what they want. That's how insane it is that I'll say this one more time, that for Jews, they want a world in which no one can express anything negative about Jews. They don't care if you hate them. They talk about hate and all. They really, I mean, I guess there are some Jews, there are Jews who care if people, they think people hate them. Sure, but I mean, the Jewish leadership, and the leadership controls 90% of Jews, at least. So they don't really care. Because if they cared that people disliked them and hated them, they would change their behavior, wouldn't they? Because their behavior is just so blatantly, such that it causes people to not to start out resenting them, but eventually you're going to just want to get rid of them. And they don't change that. So they don't care about that. All they care about is whether you can say so or not, whether you can express it. So this anti-Semitism is all about shutting everybody up and not allowing any speech about it and not allowing the words to be printed, published, spoken, or anything that would be anything negative about Jews. That is so irrational. It is so irrational that you see where Jews are coming from and why the protocols of the elders of Zion, and what's in there, rings a bell of truth to so many people. And it does still. It does. It always has. Because this idea of total control, we're going to control everything, is really the only way you can look at what the Jews are after. In how else are you going to shut everybody up? So I do, and I will come out and go along with the idea of Jewish leadership wanting to rule the world. It only follows naturally from what's known. It only makes sense. It's just that they make out that the words, when you say that, that's just so crazy, and that's just hate. Oh, that's just because you hate these people that you'd say something like that. Well, let's go on. Frederick Tobin alerted me today to the February Adelaide Institute newsletter, which just appeared. I think it's not even, I don't even know if it's actually available on their website yet, on the Adelaide Institute website. And of course, Adelaide Institute is owned and run by somebody else who, I'm sorry, I don't have his name right handy. Not by Frederick, but Frederick still is, you know, will let people know about it. And it so happens that right at the top of the first page, it has features this program of mine today, today's program, the protocols and anti-Semitism. And, the theme of this, that was very nice to see. And the theme of this, issue of the newsletter is Germans under attack. And he has at the top, not of the newsletter, but the top of the, website, the Adelaide Institute website, which I noticed today, Holocaust belief is an expression of racial hatred against Germans. I think that is excellent because Jews say Holocaust denial is an expression of racial hatred against Jews. That's what they mean. That's because Holocaust denial is another form of anti-Semitism, which is racial hatred against Jews. Well, I think we absolutely should be using this. I'm going to use it. To turn it around on them, just turn it around, and nobody could even deny it, that Holocaust belief is an expression of racial hatred against Germans. So I like that. And in the newsletter, there's a long section on Wagner with 7 parts to it, which I am definitely going to read. And the Part 5 is titled Semitism and Anti-Semitism, which should be interesting. Now, to go on, there's great stuff on that website, adelaideinstitute.org, Adelaide Institute, all one word. Although I couldn't get there by putting the URL in, I had to, you know, use the Google search page to click on, and then it went. I don't know why it didn't, but there's a lot of good stuff in those newsletters and on that website. And people should make that a regular place that they visit. Now, to get on to Frederick Stoddy, I was just looking around at stuff and I came upon this Frederick Stoddy. Not Stoddy, I've got it, I'm thinking it's Soddy. S-O-D-D-Y, kind of a funny name, but that's a lot of real old-time, you know, British names are like that. I mean, that's a real British name. I would think, Saadi. And he wrote, he was, as I said on the program announcement, he was a Nobel Prize winning chemist in 1921, and he was, and he's considered even today as the one of the fathers of nuclear fission. And he was a brilliant scientist, and I looked at his Wikipedia page, and he's a nice-looking man. He looks like a brilliant person. He's looks straight at the camera there, and he has light-colored eyes, and his eyes are just like almost, you know, not boring into you in a bad way, but just so powerful-looking. He looks probably like he's so intelligent, because he was into. He did. He's made all kinds of discoveries. Did all kinds of great work in the in physics and chemistry. And then after during and after World War One, he was so like good people are good white good intelligent white people. He was so disturbed about. What the war, World War One, revealed about what direction we were going in and so on. And so he turned to economics, and he studied economics, and he came up with some ideas of his own that he thought were better. And it said that his economics is partly based not nuclear fission, but something like that, based on thermodynamics. So he wrote the book The Role of Money, and then this little book that I had the picture of is like taken from that, and it's called Abolish Private Money or Drown in Debt. It's a pamphlet, they call it a pamphlet or a little booklet, that was printed by a nationalist organization. So while he quoted from the, protocols in his book, and in his economic writings, the economic part that we talked about, Hadding and I on Thursday, that the international Jew talked about, that kind of thing, he didn't design this book. And it said that he never expressed any outward anti-Semitism, although if he used the protocols, he accepted them as having truth in them. And he probably didn't like Jews all that much. But he wouldn't have put, I guess, this picture, this caricature of a Jew on the cover. That was the people who printed the book. I don't know that he didn't. I don't read, never read anything that he made a big fuss over it. But anyway, you know, I don't want to attribute to him things that he wouldn't do. You know, you have to be careful if you're at the level that he was at. But in this little book, there's nine, or either in this little book or in. I couldn't find the actual content, or in The Role of Money. I looked up The Role of Money on, it was archived at archive.org, but they only showed through the table of contents. And the whole book, the text of the book wouldn't come up. I did find it at google.org, I mean at Google Books, and you can read it there. But I couldn't copy any of it, and I read the chapter. I read the part "How the International Banker Rules the World." That is in Chapter 5, International Economic Relations, and amongst the subtitles, one of them was "How the International Banker Rules the World." So I thought maybe I'd find what I was looking for there, but I didn't find anything real. Well, I didn't find anything real that really stood out to me. I didn't find actual mention of the protocols there. But it is, so, and then I didn't get back to that page. I had so many other things to do. So I was gonna, you know, read it more carefully, but I didn't. But you can find it there, if you're interested. The Role of Money, Saadi at, at archive.org. At Google Books. Google Books is where you can read it. Something's wrong. And it said on archive.org, this PDF may not present itself properly. So maybe somebody screwed with it. I don't know, because nothing would come up on it except the title page and the table of contents, which was interesting in itself. But, this little booklet is put out by PTAK Science Books, and it's and somebody wrote something on there about it, and I'm going to read it. Frederick Soddy, Nobel Prize in Chemistry, 1921, and one of the fathers of nuclear fission, was also an economist. Well, an anti-economist of high order, an anti-economist preaching anti-economics on the order of the altruistic anti-economy, ideal anti-economist material, and left and nationalist economics, and so on. He is the author, along with Walter Crick, who happens to be the uncle of Francis Crick of DNA fame, of a clumsily titled pamphlet takeoff of his major works on anti-economics, Abolish Private Money or Drown in Debt, 1939. Well, this one was published in 1939, the little booklet. It was published by the Nationalist Press Association, an arm of the American Nationalist Party, which also published such works as Are All Jews Liars in 1940, The Jew in Peril and the Catholic Church, 1936, Why Are Jews Persecuted for Their Religion, 1940, and other titles. Says Soddy also quotes from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and did so 5 years after the Times ran a blistering complete denunciation of the rabid anti-Semitic creation that seems resistant to contradictory evidence to its belief. Now, this person is, you know, someone who is in the mainstream, who does not, who admires Soddy, but does not like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and is saying, though, something very interesting, I think, that it's resistant to contradictory evidence to its belief. Now, this contradictory evidence is the idea that it's a forgery, that it's, you know, was copied from Maurice Joly's Dialogues in Hell, and therefore it's worthless. It's not what it claims to be. Therefore, nobody should pay any attention to it. See, and that's the contradictory evidence. It's not all that strong, as strong as people want to make it out to be. Depends on, you know, how you want to see things. But it is resistant to this. I have been fully informed about all of this, all of the information about the forgery and so on. And I am resistant to giving up my belief in the protocols because of that. And you know, there's a lot to be said about how strong that it's true, it's actual, but it's not just a copy of that book. Some things are taken from it. That's different. So, and this reviewer says that Soddy seems to have kept his belief in the document, like any other object demanding a belief and not critical thinking, kept it alive like millions of others. Well, Soddy was certainly a critical thinker, and I'm a critical thinker too. And lots of people are critical thinkers who still don't want to give up the protocols. And he calls it that you have only a belief in the protocols, like a belief in the, you know, in a religion or something. But if you have any critical thinking, you wouldn't. But he admits that millions of people keep this belief in the protocols alive. Now, to me, that says something. You know, it says a lot. There have been forgeries that go by the wayside, but this is not that kind of a forgery. So, He says he's sorry that Saudi liked the protocols, and he thinks his cover illustration is disgraceful on this book. Let's see, what else did you say? I've got this. He says, this is also revealing. He says, I really have no idea about what Saadi is talking about in his scientific and anti-economic theory that money and banks are the ruin of the way a country and the world conducts business. So Saadi was saying that banks, money and banks, are the ruin of the way a country and the world conducts business. And this guy acts like he doesn't know what that means. All right, destruction brings immediately to mind. Okay, so after the break, I'm going to go on to New York Herald reporter Herman Bernstein, who wrote a book about the protocols and some other stuff on the protocols that I found, and why I think it's not as why the campaign against the protocols is very much part of the campaign against anti-Semitism, and that's the only that's the objection they have to it. And I'm gonna see how much value to put in all that. So thanks. Thanks for listening to the first hour, ladies and gentlemen, and I'll be back in 5 minutes.
Treuer Soldat, merkt ein namenloses Grab. Ich wünschte, ich hätte zum Gespräch. Du Kamera, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm im Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, egal. Wir werden bei euch sein. Ich schwöre dir, so wahr ich hier stehe, ich trage die Fahne, wohin ich auch gehe. Nie werde ich euch verraten, für kein Geld der Welt. Ich kämpfe für dich, ungebrochener Held. Ich kämpfe für dich, unbekannter Held. Doch ich höre deine Stimme. Gedanke zu mir sprich, du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nehmt im Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht,
egal was geschieht,
wir werden bei euch sein. Wer da noch lügt, euer Namen benutzt, eure Heldentaten durch Geld ihr beschmutzt, den trifft das Schwert von unsichtbarer Hand, ein Totenwächter von Wotan gesandt, ein Totenwächter im schwarzen Gewand. Doch ich höre eine Stimme, die sanft zu mir spricht, du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Übernehmt unseren Eid, nehmt im Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen, und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein, egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Kamerad, du siehst, wir stehen für euch ein, die Kraft, die wir brauchen, wird uns Wotan verleihen, ihr gabt so viel für dieses Land. Es war der Glaube, der euch verband. Es war der Glaube, der euch verband. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, ich sanft zu mir sprich. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir dir mal es gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid, nimmt im Geiste die Waffen. Ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen, und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht,
egal was geschieht,
wir werden bei euch sein. Und kehre ich einst an deinen Stein zurück, berichte ich dir von unserem Glück. Dann ist es geschafft und wir sind wieder frei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, darum ging's mir dabei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, denn jetzt sind wir frei. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, die sanft zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht,
egal was geschieht,
wir werden bei euch sein.
Ich höre eine Stimme,
zu mir spricht, du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Und bis an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Halt. Wir sind Geiste, die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. I'm just messing around looking for something and lost all my pages, so I have to get them back up again. My SkyCon page, where did it go? Well, it doesn't want to come up for some reason. Boy, I tell you. Things that can happen. Oh, I know what's wrong. I didn't connect this together. There. All right. Okay, I was looking, trying to look at my email, and by mistake clicked it off, and then now I can't get the right one back again. Here, I think I can do it this way to see if anybody sent me corrections to my failing memory here. Well, I got some strange things here. Submission, Hebrews, Greek, and any ideas. I don't think any of those are about this program today. So, all right. Now, I was, what was I doing? I was comparing that. All right, I got through this. Oh, I moved myself way up here. All right. I was going to start out with an overall thought, but I've let's see if I can get back to that. Well, maybe I won't, because I'm not sure that's the best thought. So I'm going to just go on and to talk about Herman Bernstein. He is a New York Herald reporter who declared the protocols were a cruel and terrible lie, invented for the purpose of defaming the entire Jewish people. So he wrote a book called The History of a Lie. And, of course, he's Jewish. He was actually born in Russia. And he didn't emigrate to the United States until he was 17. And he came with his family. And then he was very active in pro-Jewish activities and, you know, defending Jews and so on. And he went to work for the New York Herald. And the point I want to make here is that he says the line you come across most often about the protocols, and that's that the purpose is to defame the Jewish people, or the purpose of it is to spread hate against Jews, or to promote, to spread anti-Semitism. That's what they say about it. This Bernstein was, he is another one who brought a lawsuit against Henry Ford. And, he helped expose that the protocols were a forgery. In August 20th, 1921, issue of the that's Ford's paper. Okay, Bernstein, supposedly, I don't know how true this is, Henry Ford's paper, The Independent, the newspaper, identified Bernstein as the source who revealed to Ford the supposed worldwide Jewish conspiracy. Now, I don't know what all was in that Independent newspaper. I know I've seen the table of contents of a couple of them. We had that back in the beginning of the Independent Jew, the International Jew series. And they were pretty interesting. You know, it wasn't like what you'd find in a normal newspaper. There were things about Jews and about society and culture and how it's being changed and not for the good and so on. So, according to this Wikipedia article, and I have less respect for Wikipedia than ever since I've had an experience this past week with Metapedia, and I find how things can be put up on these pages there's nobody watching over that, unless somebody sees it and says, oh, and somebody who's a user or editor or something sees it and tries to fix it and change it. So all kinds of things go by. And these Wikipedia or Metapedia, the way they're run, do not guarantee that you're getting the truth about anything. According to the wiki, Bernstein was identified by Ford as being a source of the worldwide Jewish conspiracy. And supposedly, Ford is quoted as saying, he told me most of the things that I have printed. He claimed this in this article. The messenger boy of international Jewry, he called him. And Bernstein was outraged by that. And he denied it, and in 1923 he sued Ford for $200,000, and he told people at a press conference that he was doing a public service by allowing the American people to get a true picture of Ford's diseased imagination. Now, naturally, this is all written. This is on the Herman Bernstein page, but it's all written, you know, pro-Bernstein and pro-Jews and anti-Ford, so I don't know what the Ford people would say about that. But Bernstein was represented by Samuel Untermeyer, you know him, and the suit languished, though, because Bernstein and his representatives were never able to serve Ford with the subpoena. You know, they say he had many allies in among the political and law enforcement officials of Michigan, which somebody of his stature would have and should have. And elsewhere, and so they weren't able to do that. But that other lawsuit was what brought Henry Ford down. The one that Marshall was somewhat involved in, but mostly it was this other guy who brought it. I can't think of his name right now. Sonico or something. So that is the story of Henry Bernstein in his book. You can read that book is on Google Books, The History of a Lie. I took a look at it, but I don't have anything here from it. So then another source that shows that it's all about anti-Semitism is on the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum website. I found that they have several pages on the protocols, which I thought was strange. But interesting. because, you know, only supposed to be about the Holocaust, but they think the Protocols is about the Holocaust. So, they say, and on their Protocols page, it starts with a quote from Elie Wiesel, Nobel Prize, Peace Prize laureate. They always say that with his, you know, name. He said, if ever a piece of writing could produce mass hatred, it is this one. This book is about lies and slander. Mass hatred. Well, Elie Wiesel is very, very good about promoting mass hatred. So he should know. But they see, this is what they turn around, what they do, and they put it on the other shoe, the other side. And so this page says, here's what the, why did I lose my, why didn't I get this? I don't know. The Holocaust Museum says this, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion is the most notorious and widely distributed anti-Semitic publication of modern times. You know, now here, I just want to make this point that the Holocaust Museum, and of course we know it's all run by Jews. It's there because the Jews wanted it. The Jews got together money for it to start it out. They lobbied all the politicians and so on, and they just went all out to get this museum built. And it's supposed to be about the Holocaust. But now they're worrying as much or more about anti-Semitism. And they talk and write about anti-Semitism, and everything is because it's anti-Semitic. So, you know, they're also focused on that because that's what the Jews do. That's their thing. So it goes on to say that the Protocols lies about Jews. It's lies about Jews, which have been repeatedly discredited, continue to circulate today. That's good. Especially on the internet. The individuals and groups who have used the Protocols are all linked by a common purpose to spread hatred of Jews. Yeah. That's what they say there at the United States Holocaust Museum. The Protocols is entirely, they write, a work of fiction. Entirely a work of fiction. That's their opinion, actually. Intentionally written, I'm sorry, to blame Jews for a variety of ills. Those who distribute it claim that it documents a Jewish conspiracy to dominate the world. The conspiracy of its alleged leaders, the so-called Elders of Zion, never existed. And they say the origin of a lie. In 1903, the Protocols were serialized in a Russian newspaper. Now, they have a timeline. But instead of going through their timeline, I've got somebody else's timeline I'm going to use here, which goes back further than I've ever seen anything go, which is why I find it interesting. But I'll go through what the USHMM has got here, not as a timeline, but just what they write as they write it on this page. In 1903, they start out that portions of the Protocols were serialized in a Russian newspaper. That's true. But the version that has endured has been translated into dozens of languages was first published in Russia in 1905 as an appendix to the Great and the Small and so on by Russian writer and mystic Sergei Nilus. Okay, that's all true. Although the exact origin of the Protocols is unknown, its intent was to portray Jews as conspirators against the state. See, is it unbelievable, I asked, to portray Jews as conspirators against the state? Jews are and have been over and over again conspirators against the state, where they are. This is historical. And the Protocols then, I don't think its intent was to portray that, but its intent was to tell the truth as it understood it. That's the intent of the Protocols, to reveal truths. But they say that the intent was by nasty people who were anti-Semitic, who wanted to harm Jews. And they say it's allegedly minutes from a meeting of Jewish leaders describes the secret plans of Jews to rule the world by manipulating the economy, controlling the media, and fostering religious conflict. Well, that's all true. You know, they make out that that's all fiction, but that's all true. Jews manipulate the economy. They control the media, and they do foster religious conflict. No question about it. They hate all religions except their own. Now, then it says, following the Russian Revolution of 1917, anti-Bolshevik emigres brought the protocols to the West. Soon after, editions circulated across Europe, the United States, South America, and Japan, blah, blah. Beginning in 1920, auto magnate Henry Ford's newspaper, the Dearborn Independent, published a series of articles based in part on the protocols. You know, Henry Ford did more to make the protocols famous and circulate them than anybody else. I mean, I never quite realized how tied up Henry Ford was with the protocols. In reading The International Jew, I mean, I see how much we come up with there, in how many chapters they're talking about the protocols, and in a way that they find it believable and important. So, but Henry Ford, and then also Adolf Hitler, they mention these two. So they say that Adolf Hitler and Joseph Goebbels, later the Nazi minister of propaganda, praised Ford and the International Jew. See? So they liked what Ford wrote in the International Jew, and therefore they also liked the protocols. And that, you know, the International Jew was translated into 16 languages. They see, they hate stuff like that because it's still a classic and popular and read and so on. They can't get rid of it, just like they can't get rid of Mein Kampf and a lot of other stuff. And they can't get rid of the protocols. Now, in 1921, they say, and this is going on at the United States Holocaust Museum, in 1921, the London Times presented conclusive proof that the protocols was a clumsy plagiarism. The Times confirmed that the protocols had been copied in large part from a French political satire that never mentioned Jews. Marie Joly's Dialogues in Hell between Machiavelli and Montesquieu. 1864. Well, copied in large part, you know, when you look at everything that's in the protocols, there's not that much copied from Maurice Joly's book, his dialogue. Not that much. There is some, and it's close enough to word for word. I mean, it's very close, so you know it was taken from there. But they make it out that the whole book is just, you know, taken from Joly, and it's not. So then they say other investigations revealed that one chapter in a Prussian novel, Hermann Gutsche's Biarritz, in 1868, 4 years after Joly's book came out, also inspired the protocols. Well, it had, in this one chapter, it had a similar scenario because all these Jewish elders had met together in a cemetery at night and were making plans for something or other like that. So that's so there were these things that were going on at this time. This was, but you know, Joly's dialogue had nothing to do with Jews. They're right. It was about the French Revolution. But the French Revolution was about the Freemasons. But he wasn't necessarily on the side of, you know, that would appear to be the anti-Jewish side or the Jewish. I don't know what he. I'm trying to remember now. He was anti-Napoleon. Is what Jolie was. Then it says that Alfred Rosenberg of the Nazi Party introduced Hitler to the protocols in early 1920s. And Rosenberg also wrote a book about the protocols. I'd like to get hold of that. And they think that that influenced Hitler's worldview. You see, he was still developing his worldview at this time. And that Hitler, they say, because of the protocols, he exploited the myth that Jewish Bolshevists were conspiring to control the world. Well, he said that Jewish Bolshevists were conspiring to take over Europe. That's what he said, not control the world. Anyway, and they were. Now, during the 1920s and 30s, the protocols played an important part in the Nazis' propaganda arsenal, they say, here in on the Holocaust Museum site. They want to say they want to tie the protocols in with the Nazis, and then the Nazis are the ones who brought on the Holocaust. So the Nazi Party published at least 23 editions of the protocols between 1919 and 1939. In that 20-year period, they probably weren't a lot in each edition, but anyway, that is, they showed a lot of interest in it. And it says, following 1933, some schools used the protocols, but I read somewhere else that they had all the grade school kids reading things from the protocols, or they used it in their schooling of primary school students. But I thought from this that they're probably talking about Hitler youth schools and Napola schools, which were political education schools, but not in the regular schools. So I don't know what the facts are there. They may have incorporated some of it in regular education. And then they talk about how it was exposed. You know, in 1935, the Swiss court fined these two leaders, two Nazis in Switzerland, for circulating it. And that was a court case that was treated like the ones they do in Germany, Holocaust trials in Germany today, where, you know, they didn't allow the defense to enter there to bring on their witnesses. They didn't allow the defense to do, you know, to enter their information. And it was really just a it was set up, you know, it wasn't a fair kind of trial. And then they came out with the, as though this court can determine the value of the protocols of Zion. They called it ridiculous nonsense. Now, what kind of a thing is that for a court to say? And obvious forgeries and stuff. And then in 1964, this is the Holocaust Museum still. In 1964, the U.S. Senate, our great Senate, issued a report declaring that the protocols were fabricated. Now, what does the U.S. Senate know about that? They don't know. They are just, by 1964, just think about that. The year after Kennedy was assassinated and Johnson was in there, and the Jews had gotten rid of Kennedy and were in control. I do believe it had to go that way. That had to be the reason, over and above any other reasons, like Cuba and so on. And now the Jews were really in control with Johnson, and the Senate was cowed because of what happened to Kennedy. That was a message. You know, this can happen to anybody if it can happen to a president, as popular a president as John Kennedy. And nobody can do anything about it, and nobody has the guts to say other than the story that's put out and so on. So from then on, people were really towing the line, and so the U.S. Senate goes along and declares this thing about the protocols. This was all would all have been by the Jews behind it. The Jews wanted this done because they want as many of these resolutions and so on as possible, even though they don't carry any weight. They can lead to, you know, they have some influence of cultural influence, I guess, and they can lead to laws later on down the road. So they're always trying to get resolutions in their favor. And because they're just resolutions, these politicians will easily go along with it in order not to get on the wrong side of the Jews or anybody else, you know, who's in that in with them, in because it doesn't seem to hurt anything. But it has a cumulative effect, I think. Anyway, the U.S. Senate called the contents of the protocols gibberish. And as though they know, but no, how many of them even read it? They wouldn't even know. They criticized those who peddled the protocols for using the same propaganda technique as Hitler. Well, that's how the resolution would have been written, and it would be the Jews who wrote it. So that's what they passed. And then in 1993, after the opening of the Soviet Union or the breakdown of the Soviet Union, a Russian court ruled that ruled that the person who had published the protocols, a nationalist organization that had published the protocols, had committed an anti-Semitic act. Now if things go the way they want them to go, if you commit an anti-Semitic act, you can be probably given life imprisonment or the death penalty, the death sentence. Finally, they say, despite the repeated exposures of the protocols as a fraud, it remains the most influential anti-Semitic text of the past 100 years and continues to appeal to a variety of anti-Semitic individuals and groups. So that's one reason. That's a very good reason to keep the protocols alive. They want to kill the protocols as much as they can. I don't agree that they think it's helpful to them because it makes those who believe use it look bad because not that many people use it. You know, not that many people have ever read it or pay attention to it. But it's the most influential anti-Semitic text in their opinion. So that's a reason to be careful not to dismiss it and throw it away because you think that you don't want to have any question about your credibility whatsoever and things like that. Now, then they got the U.S. Department of State, who in their report on global anti-Semitism in 2004, to write in this report, the clear purpose of the protocols is to incite hatred of Jews and of Israel. So by 2004, the State Department was including Israel in anti-Semitism. And you know, why would the State Well, these things, you know, the fact that the State Department even has anything like that is wrong. But then, you know, this website says that, it's nothing new. Neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and Holocaust deniers endorse and circulate the protocols. Well, that is pretty important because they're lumping in Holocaust deniers with neo-Nazis and white supremacists. All three are the worst things anybody can be. And they're saying that all three of these groups endorse the protocols and circulate the protocols. Not necessarily, but that's what they say. So they tie in the protocols with Holocaust denial. Then they have, okay, here's this, this is not the timeline, but this is something that they have on there. I talked about Lucian Wolf when I was talking about the protocols back when, last year. But I don't think this is too important. I'm going to pass this by. Where is that other one? Oh, I wonder if I don't have it here. I was going to go. Oh, here it is. All right, it's here. There's this article, Reviving the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, by Arnold Allert. And where was this? Let's see. Jewish World Review. Well, I don't know if that's where it appeared, but he's a contributing columnist to the conservative website JewishWorldReview.com. And he wrote a long article about the protocols. He's Jewish. And he says, he brings up this 30-minute YouTube film called The American Dream. I watched that last night. I don't think I had ever seen it before. I've seen some things like this, but I don't think I've seen this one. Although maybe I just, you know, it was a while back and I just didn't remember it. But it's pretty good. YouTube, The American Dream, you'll find it. It was made after the economic collapse of 2008. But what's interesting about it is that it refers to ideas, they say, from the protocols and to the Rothschilds and the Red Shield and how evil bankers and so on. So this guy says that he says he's just writing a kind of a thing against collectivism, this film, and a libertarian type of a thing. But the author says there's a troubling undercurrent which revisits one of the oldest anti-Semitic conspiracy theories in existence, that we are all slaves of Jewish bankers who run the entire world. That's the old conspiracy that they can't get rid of, the old idea that people cling to, that we're all slaves of Jewish bankers who run the entire world. Well, I don't think it would retain its currency like that if there wasn't truth in it and people didn't know and realize. So he says that the origins of the protocols, the protocol originates, it goes back to a pamphlet published in 1797. That's the earliest date I've seen. By French Jesuit Abbé Barruel, B-A-R-R-U-E-L, who blamed the French Revolution of 1789 on a conspiracy of Freemasons. So here they're saying that the Freemason connection is real, which is the Joly, what Joly was talking about too, the French Revolution. And that is where the idea that that the Jewish bankers are setting out to run the world, take over the world, so on. As far as finances go, you know, that's the way it's portrayed, that's the way they will accomplish it, through money and economics power. So then it goes, so 1797 is 100 years before 1897, which is the given date for when supposedly this meeting took place in Switzerland of the elders, Zion, of the Jewish elders, and that is what is written about in the protocols, that they actually had a meeting, and these are like the minutes of their meeting that took place in 1897. That's the general idea. So 100 years before that, 1797, this guy wrote something. This French Jesuit wrote something similar about the French Revolution. So this is an idea that just, you know, goes back quite a ways. And in fact, it goes back further than that. I mean, you know, for sure. But this is kind of more a direct line up to the protocols. So then comes Maurice Joly and his satire on against Napoleon and the Napoleonists And that doesn't mention Jews. And then, though, this Hermann Goetze, in a few years after that, so Jolie was, why don't they have that date here? Jolie was 1864, as I recall. And then in 1868, Goetze's novel, Biarritz, in which he has a chapter where all these Jewish elders are meeting in a cemetery and coming up with the same ideas about how to take over the world. And that is supposedly what the protocols came from, those two sources. But really, there's way too much in the protocols that's not in these two sources. And so whoever wrote the protocols, though, clearly must have, not so clear with Goetze, but very clear with Maurice Joly, you can see that some of the passages are taken directly from what he wrote. But then it said that there's the idea that possibly he took what he wrote from somewhere older than 1864. Well, what was in this thing, this 1797 thing by Abbe Berulle? He's an Abbe is a title. So that's that. Takes us to there. And then after that, there was a consolidation of his work. I guess they mean Goetze's work, published as The Rabbi's Speech in 1891. And then a redacted version was, they say, was created by the Okhrana, the Russian secret police in France. And that they named the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Now, I don't know that that's been quite really disputed, that the idea that the Okhrana was involved in this is just kind of a hearsay. Somebody mentioned it or something, but there's no proof of that whatsoever. And if they're the secret police, I guess there wouldn't be. But, that's not a sure thing at all. That's where the protocols as we know them came from. So in this version from the Okhrana, supposedly, it's the story of Jewish elders who meet in Switzerland in 1897. They've got a date there. It's like, okay, this was taken from a meeting in 1897, because there were some Jewish meetings at that time. World of Zionist meetings. But that nobody has been able to show that this kind of thing was what was on the agenda. So I think it's kind of fictional, the whole thing, but it's been going on. It doesn't mean that the ideas that are in here and that have what has been, I guess added to it and so on, is fiction or is wrong or is not true or, of course Jews would never do such a thing as that. And, there's no truth to it. That doesn't mean, none of this means that. That's what I'm always saying. So I just go right ahead with, the protocols and using them and seeing, how much value, how much you can get in understanding what's going on from them. So, they admit that, this guy admits that, despite this, this knowing about the plagiarizing, it took until 1993 before a Russian court, declared it as a forgery. Now, that's a 90 year interim again, so that's almost another 100 years. So for 200 years, now this thing has been, living and nobody can seem to kill it, can destroy it. So, then they're putting it down. He's putting it down and so on. He says that, that every attempt to achieve some kind of extra national organizing, for example, globalization, can be traced back to the protocols. Well, that's Jew speech, I say. You know, to say that to explain it that way, to say that Ford and others were referring to something that that is only found in the protocols is false, because there's all kinds of evidence for this going on all the time, and it's growing and gaining, you know, starting with things like NAFTA, all these things that people don't want. Nobody wants these things, but somehow we get them anyway. We can't prevent getting them, even though we don't want them, the majority of people. So this film then is like, what's wrong with this film is that the hero is black, or he's a half black guy, and the poor little, he's not the dummy who needs to be saved from his own stupidity is the white guy. But still, I think it's pretty good, because white people do need to be saved from their own gullibility. White people are believing in all this stuff. White people do allow Jews to do all kinds of things, and it keeps saying, "Oh, they can't mean that. Oh, it must be okay. Oh, what's so wrong with it?" And so on. White people do that. So this guy, I don't know. He's dark and swarthy, but he's tough. He's tougher where the white guy is not tough. He's a little wimp. But he's honest, you know. He's honest and truthful. So it's not all that bad, really. I think it's fairly effective, because as soon as the hero black guy takes the little white guy off back into the past to see how this thing all got started, they come to the house of Rothschild, and and they call it a Frankenstein-like castle, which is true. And there's inside there are these bankers whose faces are red shields. See? Red shields. And they all have these red shield faces. And then there's this monster with all the tentacles who also has a red shield face. And so this is, you know, like blaming Rothschild, blaming the Jews again, which we know what the Rothschilds have done, and then it goes through how they made all that money on the Battle of Waterloo, in Britain, Nathan Rothschild, and it goes through a lot of interesting stuff. Pretty fast, it's pretty fast moving, and then you have this secret meeting, you know, that's where the Federal Reserve came into being, was dreamed up and decided on, and this red shield face guy shows up there too and takes over, and they all bow down to him. All these big bankers like J.P. Morgan and so on that are there. And then in the end, you have the final confrontation. They even talk about JFK in there. Then you have the final confrontation, and the big, big red shielded, oh no, the big Darth Vader kind of guy comes forward to against this the black hero fellow who's been leading this other guy through all this, and he takes off his mask and he's Hank Paulson. This was made back then when Hank Paulson was Treasury Secretary, but because we're now dealing just with the Federal Reserve in the United States, and he tries to get the other guy to join up, come over on their side, and he'll have everything he ever wanted, you know. Don't be a fool, because this Hartman has a lot of followers by now. His name is Hartman, the black guy. He has a lot of followers. But Hartman, you know, like they do in these fantasy things, he just kind of gives him a shot. He pulls out a sword, and he pokes at him with the sword, pokes at Paulson, the red shield, the big top guy behind it all. And he falls into this hole and goes down into this vast and endless hole, I guess. And that's the end of the story. Supposedly we won. Well, you know. But he brought this writer who's revealing this film, this cartoon film, and saying that it has these it's woefully short of historical and or economic knowledge. He says it's a simplistic cartoon, but it actually has the truth of everything. He says, though, that it doesn't really explain how banking is done. Well, you know what? It does explain the kind of banking that we have. Banking is very simple. Banking is nothing that anybody couldn't understand if it was explained to them. But they want to put across the idea that banking is something very complex and only these great economists and people understand it. And therefore, people need to just trust these people. But it's not true. So what this little film reveals is the real story of what goes on with not your average bank on the corner, but with international banking and central banking and so on. They want us to still believe that we have to have these central banks. Well, and if central banks were conducted in an honest way, they could be useful. But we don't need to have them if you have nations that are conducting things in an honest way. It's all about honesty. It's all about doing things in the best interests of the people and the people's economy and so on. It's not about banking styles and measures and so on. It's just about what your intention is, not to rob people. But this points out, this little film, that people are being robbed all the time, you know, and we are being robbed. We absolutely are robbed. Anybody can see that today. So therefore, everything in the protocols comes to pass, and it's useful no matter what the origins of it are. It's very useful because I don't know, as I've said before, I don't know of anything that has a powerful effect as reading the protocols. It has this haunting kind of quality to it, and you recognize things that aren't said straight out, but you recognize it as what's gone on in more recent times, and you think, gosh, you know, and it's shown as evil as it really is, because it really is evil. We're always being given by the media and our governments to think, they have our best interests in mind, and they can't help it. The economy is sinking. Oh, they didn't have anything to do with it. Oh, they're trying to help it. Oh, without them, we would really be sunk. You know, and all this baloney. So let me go on here. Another good page is, well, another place that has pages on the protocols is HEART, that place called Holocaust Education and Research Project, HEART, that has lots of pages about Holocaust. They're Holocaust believers, 100%. And they have two pages on the protocols, and they actually publish the actual protocols on those pages. You can read the whole thing there, and they have a lot of pictures. And they only say up at the top that their aim is to inform and educate people. No, that's somewhere else. Where is this? Where is that other thing? Oh, they say at the top, the protocols have been proven by respected international scholars, both Jewish and non-Jewish, to be a forgery and a hoax, as well as a clear case of plagiarism. The original source has been clearly identified as an 1864 book by Maurice Joly entitled The Dialogue in Hell Between Machiavelli and Montesquieu, which was written as a satirical attack against the ambitions and methods of French Emperor Napoleon III. Well, the thing is that the source of the protocols is not Maurice Joly's book. There are passages taken from Marie Scholey's book, but Marie Scholey's book is not the source of the protocols, and that can be shown easily. It cannot be proved. It cannot be shown that it is. They would not be able to do it. But they say that anyway. They say it. And then they go on that they're printing this exactly as it was found, you know. And the purpose of doing so is for readers to understand the methods in which the Nazi propaganda machine would seek to dehumanize the victims of its genocidal actions. Well, you know, dehumanizing its victims is exactly what the Jews do and have always done. How can you dehumanize something more than by saying Goyim are not real, are not people. Goyim don't have souls. The only real people are Jews and, you know, so on. And Goyim are meant to serve Jews and so on. How can you do that more than the way they do it? But there's another case where they turn it around. They turn your complaints against them around back on you. Now, the thing is, this HEART website, which is a large website, Holocaust Education and Archive Research Team, was founded by Carmelo Licciotto. Licciotto? That's an Italian name. And Chris Webb in 2006. And it says the aim of this site is to inform and educate people about the Holocaust and the extermination programs conducted by the Nazi regime throughout Europe during the Second World War. Well, they got to keep that going, don't they? They have to keep the idea in people's minds that there was an extermination program conducted by Nazis throughout Europe. And then I found out, I looked up Carmelo Licciotto, L-I-S-C-I-O-T-T-O, and he didn't have a regular Wikipedia page, but he had a Wikipedia user page. So that's where I found that he's a Wikipedia user, which means, and for many, many years he has been. Plus, he's an IT expert, it says, so he knows how to use the computer and do all these things. And so he's been one of the people at Wikipedia who makes sure that Wikipedia is always Holocaust friendly. I bet he really knows his way around. I bet anything you put on there, he can, you know, if you would try to do it, he can take down, he can change. He's watching over all that. And, you know, there's no way ahead with these people who've already got control of all this stuff. You have to go a different direction. Now, the last thing I'm going to be able to talk about here, and it's the last thing I have, is back to the Harold Marcuse website. He's that, somebody wrote to me, said he thought it was the grandson of the original Marcuse, which I, again, I don't know. His name is what? Herman? I don't think so. I thought it was something else with an H, but he was part of the Frankfurt group. Yeah, last week somebody sent me an email that said what the word I was looking for was Frankfurt group. True. It was. I couldn't think of that either. Okay, I just looked at my email again, but I don't see anything that just looks like it's for this program. So they have, this Mark Hughes is really quite an oddball, and he's another Holocaust fanatic, and he writes on, they have a page there on that, on his website, just for anti-Semitism. So I have some things there from that, because again, I think that anti-Semitism is a bigger fight for Jews to stop anti-Semitism than is Holocaust denial or anything else. Because it all boils down in their eyes. Everything that would not be in their favor all boils down to anti-Semitism. Or I should say, the threat that they face boils down to anti-Semitism in whatever form it's appears. And Holocaust denial is just one form. So anti-Semitism means, you know, that people will not hold these Jews free from criticism. They used to be criticized, and that's when they're held in check. But now, once they got free from being criticized, and people were afraid of doing that, and that really is surprising, but it really only fully took effect after World War II, or during World War II, or around that time. You know, they still complain about how badly they were treated during the war. And I've got something here. Maybe that's what I should be reading here. That's on this anti-Semitism page that I am reading. All right, but they say, I'll get into it, because he says, that somebody did this research, you know, supposedly. And they said another type of anti-Semitism in America was passive anti-Semitism. While many Americans would not physically harm a Jew, they're talking about the war years, they had negative internal feelings toward them. So you can't even have that, because they're worried about that. Therefore, you're not going to help the Jews. That's why people weren't, in America, they weren't inclined to care about the Jews in Europe during the war. And then they say that in national public opinion polls, results show that over half the American population saw Jews as greedy and dishonest. This was in the 30s that they're talking about, and early 40s. And I thought, yeah, they think that's, they said that's a frightening proportion. Well, you know, half the American population saw Jews as they are. They are greedy and dishonest. Well, they can't allow us to see them the way they really are, or at least they can't allow us to say so. I've said that already. I can't emphasize that enough. Tan talks about that all the time, too. And they say that they believe that many Americans believe that Jews were too powerful in the United States. Now, I would say today, people would be reluctant to admit that, even in an anonymous poll. You know, I think people are reluctant because they've been convinced that that is racist to talk like that. What we need to be working at is to overthrow the whole idea that we can't be anti-Semitic or we can't criticize Jews. We need to start doing it more. I don't know. It's not just we, because when I say we, tiny amount of people. But this is the idea, I think, that needs to be put out there and promulgated more and more. Not how can we get the Jews to behave better? How can we get the Jews to, you know, be nicer or something? That's not going to happen. What has to be done is, how can we stop, absolutely refuse to be quiet about the Jews and what we see in the Jews, as people used to be able to be? This is a new kind of thing we're into now, where we can't say bad things about Jews. And we need to do it and do more of it, and we need to encourage people to do it by pointing out all the bad things that Jews are doing. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of this show today. And Monday I'm going to have the entire staff of the White Network on the Heritage Hour. See you then.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.